think we'll go ahead and call the meeting to order. First, can I get an approval for the minutes, April 10, 2017?
So moved.
Is there a second? Any corrections? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Any public comments? I don't have any chairman comments, so go ahead with the presentation.
Just by way of introduction, there was a video that was played at the recent prenatal to five summit, and we thought every bit of 2 minutes, so we thought it would be a bit overcap to the presentations that will follow today. So we have a short video for you this morning, this afternoon. Does require you to read a little bit, but this seems to be a common thread now with some of your videos. My name is Pamela Smith. I'm the coordinator of the Life Course Initiative for Healthy Families, also known as our Infant Mortality Prevention Project. And we are now entering, as I give Karen time to get the PowerPoint up, our seven years? I think I lost track. 7 years. We began in 2010 here, as you may remember from my previous presentations, with a two-year planning grant, then two additional years for implementation and life grants, some of which went to community organizations. And now we are in the midst of a five-year, 2015 to 2019, policy systems and environmental change grant, which many of the funders are looking at systems and policies and environmental change as opposed to direct services. Thank you. Okay. So our overall goals and objectives are, since funding really is to maintain and sustain collaborative partnerships, we have about a core of 20 active members and 11 or 12 organizations that meet bi-monthly and are always interested in engaging new stakeholders and representatives from the community. When we did our environmental scan and survey a couple of years ago, maternal mental health rose as a priority among our collaborative partners and what they were seeing with families and women during pregnancy and postpartum. And so we are looking to address that. We took on a community health navigator, half-time position, combined with the county's mental health coordinator to help navigate and assist women with local resources and or treatment for postpartum depression. We took coordinating referrals and our outreach with the Race and Community Action Agency are some of our primary objectives there. And then we have three work groups addressing advocacy, family, and father involvement. And then looking at images and stigma and the impact of images and stigma on mental health. In year three, which we just completed March 31st, we did implement the community health navigator position. We have our signature event, which is the annual diaper supply drive. So not only do we distribute diapers to families coordinating with our partner agencies, but we actually supply three or four agencies here in the community that then continue that that service year-round. I mentioned our work groups. We've redone and reset our website and contributed to blogs bi-monthly as well. We had the occasion to participate with the United Way to promote the Earned Income Tax Credit as a effort to improve income, and then working with the volunteers tax assistance programs. We also did some presentations nationally at the annual conferences and worked with the Emerging Unity Coalition, which Gwen is taking a significant leadership role in and may want to say something more about that. Some barriers is attrition. We had several organizations to have staff turnover, which then challenged us with some of our leadership positions. The community has emerging new coalitions with Strive, with Unity. KHIP was around for a year or so, and a lot of shifting in stakeholders and membership. But connecting between each other helps to minimize that impact. And then our community health navigator has run into a little bit of challenge with the mental health referrals in that a lot of the providers only take a limited number of Medicaid recipients, and then when they reach their limit, then we're sometimes taxed with finding additional services. Let's get there. We had some community conversations where we presented activities in the community. We had a doula and midwives seminar over at the Kenosha Public Museum that was well attended, and we're looking to continue some efforts there. I mentioned the Unity Coalition. The Dedicated Dads program grew out of the LIFE grant and continues to be a strong commitment for dads and families there, working with child support and other initiatives. We're looking at our HMOs. We have a significant number of HMOs on our collaborative, maybe six or seven, and we're looking at how the incentives that they provide to families and their members may help the participation and engagement of women in the mental health services, continuing our partnership with the Boys and Girls Club. And then housing emerged as a priority identified by the collaborative members. And we're exploring that, thinking that the Emergency Services Network has a pretty strong involvement there with the homeless issues and shelters. But looking at, in particular, the Kenosha Housing Authority presented to our collaborative, and we're looking at the impact of evictions on pregnant or new moms. And so those are emerging kinds of strategies that we're looking at for year four, along with our action plan, leveraging that navigator position, along with other efforts around reducing stress and maternal mental health. There's an anti-stigma public awareness campaign that has been proposed that we are in the process of considering, along with identifying additional stakeholders to partner with. And then the benchmarks are, of course, just showing increase in success along those same measurements. And then given that we have this grant is scheduled to end in 2 years, we want to look at ways to integrate the Kenosha Life Collaborative into our system with DOH and the Healthy People Kenosha County in terms of structural, having a place to locate the collaborative, and then for funding, trying to identify grants and other funding or sponsorships. And of course, job sharing, which we currently do by having a half-time project assistant shared within the division as well as the half-time community health navigator. So that is the update and progress report for the Kenosha Life Project. And I would entertain any questions.
Yeah. Any questions?
Just kind of related. Up in Milwaukee, they've been doing there's an organization doing the baby boxes.
Do you know
what those are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually had the representative Todd Onstead to stop by about a week or so ago.
And they're expanding down into Kenosha.
Yes.
And we're going to be getting them over at the Community Health Center.
Oh, you are?
We've had them for about a year. Yeah. Yeah, and the home visiting program, they'll speak in a minute, but they can talk more about the baby boxes or the baby nest, as we call them. Because they really do look like boxes, and women are kind of stigmatized by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had a question on the funding. I mean, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are multiple counties getting funded one way or another through this.
Correct.
And, I mean, do you think it is in jeopardy for the next renewal, or just hard to say, you never know?
Well, it was the Wisconsin Partnership Program made a 10-year commitment up front when we initially started this. And so we've gone through two cycles of 2-year grants, and this is a 5-year. I do believe the funds will be available to continue some efforts around this initiative of birth outcomes and infant mortality across counties, but I think it's going to look different. I'm not quite sure what to expect, but I do think there'll continue to be some kind of commitment through those Wisconsin partnership funds.
And Pam has been here since 2010, but it actually started in 2009 with a feasibility grant on how we were, a planning grant, which I presented to the board to try to figure out how we were going to do this. And now we're reflecting almost on our 10-year efforts. And what we see is that Kenosha, the mortality rate, is much lower than other communities that are part of this initiative. So we've really done a good job, not only micro, but then macro level too. So it's really interesting how where Kenosha fits. Right?
What comment on the Unity Coalition?
Yeah, the Unity Coalition is actually a partnership between the law enforcement agencies in the community and public health, looking at violence as a public health issue. And with some of the recent gun violence that has occurred, the Unity Coalition is actually there to mitigate or to eliminate some of those problems, at least to reduce the reoccurring violence from that initial incident. So we have got the DA's office, we've got KPD, and some of the other community efforts in NAACP, Peace on the Streets. So we've got a lot of very diverse members coming together to try to look at how their particular organization, agency, or influence can reduce violence.
And then one other observation I'd like to make about the infant mortality effort is, as our rates have improved, because they've reduced here in Kenosha County for infant mortality, but prematurity has spiked. So Gwen and I have had discussion about mortality versus morbidity, that we're saving more babies, but not birthing them quite as healthy as we'd like to see. And so nationwide, prematurity has been on the increase. So
one thing I might think of there is we're making the moms a little bit healthier, but not healthy enough to carry them to term.
Yes.
So those that would have lost the child before or aborted the child before are now carrying it to prematurity.
Yes, good observation.
I think that as we look at what sustainability looks like, we'll start to focus more on morbidity as opposed to mortality. Because I think that if we don't, Kenosha is going to fall out of the bigger view for grantors. So we really need to focus on how we're going to do the 39 weeks initiative, which is a national initiative to keep those babies cooking for the full, you know, term, and then to look at how we can really partner with the OB community to make sure that whatever efforts, including home visitation, that we can really get into those homes and get into that sphere of that woman's environment and really link with her to get a healthier outcome.
Well, it would seem like that's an easier piece of data to measure than some of these, and I am wholeheartedly behind these initiatives, but a lot of them are longer term goals.
Absolutely.
And
right.
So how do you prove that to the congressman or whatever each year?
Yeah. Well, again, I'm glad we kind of bunched all of these individuals up together, because Pam is talking about that community macro level, but then we actually looked at evidence-based I don't know who's next, but I'm keying
we
up.
We are next.
Yes.
I'm keying them up. We looked at evidence-based programs in order to look at the woman individually and the family, and that's, I'll let you go, just in.
Right.
Well,
Mr.
O'Day
had his hand up.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In terms of the pregnancy area, how many have family or don't have family? As far as, are these women alone or not? Is there a statistic on this next presentation that goes into that or not?
I don't know that we have that statistic in there.
I don't think I do either.
There are risk factors, but when they talk about them, there are multiple risk factors. Race, income, number of children. There's a lot of risk factors that we use to determine which women we will engage with to make sure that we can improve that family's health. So I hear what your question is, but I don't know if we're going to be able to define today whether they're homeless or single family households. Is that what you're asking?
I mean, is there a number of women that don't even take advantage of the programs? Is there something that just say, hey, I'm not interested in any of that, and go along and whatever.
Yeah, and I think you have the number of referrals versus the ones that enroll.
Yeah. No, not in here I don't. Number of referrals versus how many enrolled, but we can get that number.
Okay.
Yeah, we can get that number because,
It kind of goes back to, again, with mental health or drugs or something, if you don't want to step up to the table sometimes, I don't know that kind of stuff. Who's there that's not really participating in a program that we're missing? How can we really get to them?
Yeah.
What is there to get to them?
Well,
Well, to answer your question, one of the reasons we expanded from Nurse Family Partnership to Parents as Teachers was to capture more women, because the original program, NFP, was just for new moms. They could not have other children. Where the second program, PAT, you can have children and continue to be in this program or volunteer to be in this program. So as we look at other opportunities for expansion and to reach out to a wider base of people that could potentially we could reach and provide home visitation information, which is really supportive care. That's what this program is all about, supportive care and education.
Thank
you. Ready? Okay. I'm Lori. This is Brianna. We are both team leads of each program. I oversee the partners, also sometimes called PAT or Parents as Teachers program, and Brianna oversees the NFP or Nurse Family Partnership program. So our goal is to educate pregnant women on how to have a healthier pregnancy, birth, and hopefully some self-improvement strategies. Sometimes the goals are tiny. Sometimes they're big. They're identified by the family, though. We don't get to drive that part. The PAT team has the ability to follow babies until they are three, and right now we have babies that have hit two. So we've been a little better than 2 years working on the PAT program. And the Nurse Family Partnership program can see children until the children are two. They're both evidence-based models. Parents as teachers will see the multi-parous women or the women that have had children before, whereas the Nurse Family Partnership will see the first-time mom only. Our referral sources are all over the place. Our biggest referral source is WIC, but interestingly enough, we have had a spike in just walk-ins. They hear about us in the community, and they will walk up to the desk and ask to enroll from there. We get calls from the hospitals. We get calls from HMOs. We've had a couple of those recently. So really all over the place we get referrals from. So our contact with the clients, most of it is going to be face-to-face in the home. We can, of course, talk on the phone with them. We text a lot. The clients, you know, the moms are younger. They are very savvy with the technology, and they like to text. We provide information on all the services that we offer here, including the crib and car seat programs and vaccinations. We give information on community resources. Lots of these kids are referred out to early intervention, to early Head Start, so we are connected that way. And then, of course, facilitating dental services. And all of our programs are voluntary, and these moms know this. And we take great pains to make sure that they know we are nurses and not social workers, and we're there to help, and we're not there to be punitive. And once they trust us, from that trust, then we can hopefully partner with them better. So the visits typically last about an hour, hour and a half. During the pregnancy, we might meet with just the mother, or it might be the mother and her partner. If she has other children, there could be little kids running around as well, so sometimes that can be fun, or not. Meeting locations ideally in the home, but we are willing to meet wherever mom is willing to meet. Some of them don't necessarily want us into the home initially, so we'll meet here, or at a community location during the school year. The nurses will go out to the school campuses. Very often after delivery, they're more comfortable with us, and they will then allow us into the home. So lots of education that goes on. Again, it's all driven by her. She says, you know what, I don't want to hear anything about birth, but I'm really interested in birth control afterwards. Or don't be talking to me about breastfeeding. We're going to give her all the information we can on whatever it is that she wants to learn about. Talking to her about coordinating care and connecting to other community partners when she has a need, and then trying to give them the tools to succeed, basically. We have a big focus on, you know, trying to identify goals and how are you going to get to that goal and what can I do to help you meet that goal. Some of our clients have enrolled in secondary education, which is awesome to see that happen. Others have made active plans around the reproductive life plan, which is important. You know, if you're not planning your children, then you have no plan, and that's just dictating everything. So just kind of helping them identify where are you going to be in 5 years? What do you see yourself doing in 10 years? So for the Parents as Teachers PT program, we will take pregnant moms who already have kids. We will also take those first-time moms that fall out of the NFP program, so they can only take pregnant moms up until their 28th week. We can take them after that. We can also accept moms that have already delivered and have a demonstrated need for home visitation services. So sometimes we'll get a phone call from a social worker in the hospital or maybe a physician's office, and, you know, hey, we've got this mom. She really could use services. She's willing, and we'll pick her up that way. They are all low income. It is a voluntary program, and again, we do work with the babies until they are three. We had discussed risk factors before. There's a huge long list of risk factors that we do screen for, and it's anything from health issues to demographics to you know, their income, previous pregnancy outcomes, language. So there's a long list that can make them more at risk. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so NFP, as we said, is an evidence-based program. So it has been tested over about 30 years, since like the 1970s. And it is for first-time moms who are low income. They have to be under the 29 weeks pregnant. And it is voluntary until the baby turns two. And then both programs teach on a variety of educational topics. And again, both of these programs are client-centered, so whatever the client would like to talk about is what we talk about. You know, we do prepare before the visit, so we have all of our information to give them, but, you know, stuff comes up, and they ask us different questions then, so we you know, like to base it on what they're interested in. So these are just some of the topics that we go over with them. These are the different screening tools we use. The first one is the ASQ. It's the Ages and Stages questionnaire. These are developmental screenings for the babies because it's better to test the baby earlier to see, make sure they're meeting all their milestones so that we can get them into interventions earlier than waiting until they go to kindergarten when it's better to get them in earlier. The next three are the depression screening, the anxiety screening, and the perceived stress scale, and also the adverse childhood experience. All these screenings are helpful to determine if the mom needs additional interventions, and usually based off one of these four screenings is when we determine if our mental health coordinator should also be involved with the client. And that's the next screening is about the mental health coordinator. So like I said, based off those other screenings, the client may state that she would like additional services. Then the mental health coordinator will come with the nurse to the next visit. And then the mental health coordinator can connect her with different community resources in addition to the mental health, because she does work with all different kinds of community resources around. And then she also, once she hooks the client up with a different community resource, say like a counselor or something, she will follow up with the client to make sure that fit her needs and that she is comfortable with what services she has. Some of our community partners are listed here. These are some of the people who we collaborate with. Like Lori mentioned, WIC is one of our big ones. We do get a lot of our referrals from them, and most of our clients that we have are involved with WIC. These are some of the stats from 2016. So through the Safe Sleep program, in 2016, 83 pack and plays were distributed along with the Safe Sleep information. The numbers for 2015 are also listed to compare to. For the car seat program, we distributed 185 car seats with checks, and then there were 71 checks done. For the high-risk referrals, there were 24 in total for 2016, and these high-risk referrals usually come from the hospitals. And then First Breath is a program to help stop moms who are smoking. So it's a smoking cessation program. 10 were enrolled for 2016. And then Baby Cafe, which Lori usually runs, has, usually has 2 to 3 women in attendance. And since Lori is a certified lactation, international board certified lactation.
Breastfeeding nurse.
Yes. Yes.
Keep it simple.
She's able to like perform a lactation assessment or anything that the client might need at that time. So it's very nice.
I do want to back up just a second. Brianna had touched on the pack and place, and you guys were asking about the baby boxes earlier. We do have a newborn, the newborn nest program here. Clients are offered the option. Most of them do prefer the pack and place. They last longer. They hold up better. However, the newborn nest people are looking to expand, and I know that United Hospital is talking to them now, so I don't know what will happen from that, but hopefully for those that we, for whatever reason, don't touch, hopefully there'll be other places that will touch them.
And two, if we give out a newborn nest, we would also give out the pack and play as well, because the newborn nest would only be in certain situations if, you know, the pack and play doesn't fit, or if we had one mom who was sleeping on an air mattress and had a C-section, and it would be a lot harder for her to get up in the middle of the night to get to the baby in the pack and play, then the newborn nest might be more, might be easier for her. And so we do give them both out. So then they have the newborn nest first, then they would also have the pack and play.
So some of the improvement projects that we're working on right now, we completed a breastfeeding project through HB Coin last year, I think it ended, to improve our breastfeeding initiation and continuation rates. The state wide home visitation programs are working on breastfeeding. We were asked to be mentors, so we are providing support to other groups that are working on that. And we are actively working on the state maternal depression project. And right now, our focus is ensuring that moms get to the referral sources that we've made to them, and hopefully then had an improvement in their depression screenings. So current stats for PAT, we have 2 full-time, 1 part-time nurse home visitors, and that does not include myself. We have a part-time administrative assistant. We currently have 37 active clients, and there are 6 additional scheduled right now for first visits. 26 babies with 1 set of twins. Since last year, there have been 576 visits, and we've serviced 78 clients since June 6th. Since our program began in 2015, we have serviced 100 families. Our outcomes, over the past year, one of the births out of the 26 was less than 7 weeks. That same infant also had low birth weight and spent time in the NICU. There have been, as far as pregnancies go, 0 subsequent pregnancies at the 6-month interval, 2 subsequent pregnancies at the 12-month interval. One was planned as mom had advanced maternal age, and the other was unplanned. 82% of our clients initiated breastfeeding. This is actually pretty impressive for the group that we're working with. So I'm pretty proud of that. And then all of our children have been screened at 4, 9, and 18 months of age for ASQs through referred for further evaluation and who are receiving additional services.
And then the current status for the Nurse Family Partnership. We currently have 6 nurse home visitors. 2 of them are still in training. One is actually currently in NFP training right now. So we have 84 active clients for the 4 nurses who have the caseloads. And I believe we have 4 newly scheduled clients right now. We have 53 babies. Since June 6th of last year, there's been 1,433 visits, and 164 clients have been served since June of last year. And then since the program began in 2012, 740 families have been served. So for our NFP pregnancy and birth outcomes, we have 82% of the clients have had a first prenatal visit in the first trimester. One client was a cigarette smoker, and by the 36 weeks, client stated that she was no longer smoking. Two births out of 20 were preterm. Three births out of 20 were low birth weight, and two out of the 20 babies had to stay in the NICU that were born in between the time frame of June of last year to June of this year. For the NFP maternal outcomes, again, this is from June of last year to June of this year, two out of the 37 clients had a subsequent pregnancy at 6 months postpartum, and then during that time frame, two out of the 18 clients had a subsequent pregnancy at 12 months. At intake, there were 109 clients who were enrolled in WIC, and at 24 months when they were entering the program, only one client was enrolled in WIC. 115 clients were enrolled in Medicaid, and at the end of the program, only two clients were enrolled in Medicaid. And then at intake, 54 were enrolled in food stamps, and by the end of the program, zero were enrolled in food stamps. So this is one of our goals for the clients, is to become self-sufficient, so that's why those numbers are important. Then 75% of our clients initiated breastfeeding. 100% of our children were current with immunizations at 6 months, 12 months, and 18 months. 100% of the children at 4 months of age and at 10 months of age were assessed using the Ages and Stages questionnaire. Out of all those, one 4-month-old and one 10-month-old were referred on for further evaluation. And then here are some pictures from our parent-led activity network. We do smaller events monthly, and then we do two larger events during the year. And this is just for clients and families to network, socialize, and do fun activities. We are trying to get the parents to lead it more, but we have been doing most of the organizing for it. And usually we have like different stations set up, so we have a handprint art activity to do. We usually take their photograph, and then we print it out for them and give that to them. We usually have a sensory table they can play in. We usually have a book area where they can look at books and read books or have a book read to them. And then sometimes we have a little dance area for them to listen to music and dance. And then this is a picture of some of the other activities we have going on. So Kenosha News interviewed one of our NFP clients and shared that article in the Mother's Day edition. That one's up in the upper right-hand corner. And this client will be going to the Parent Advocacy Program in D.C. this week to share her story as well. This story was also shared in the West of the Eye article, which is down in the bottom right. And then we had State Representative Todd Onstad sent us a letter in the mail, and that's the picture of that over there. And then he also came, as Pam mentioned, and that's the picture of him with some of the staff members when he came to do the visit. And then on the top right is our NFP client who also went on to become a nurse. So the NFP interviewed her, and she was in the NFP NewsLink article. The over to the side of the right here, Lori and I wrote an article about breastfeeding, and it was published in the Home Visiting newsletter. Any questions?
The information you gave about the food stamps, getting off of food stamps, getting off of this, getting off of that, and you touched on it because you said, you know, the goal is to help them be self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make sure that how are we helping them be self-sufficient, and are we able to document that, you know, yes, they're getting off of food stamps, but that's not, that they're still in poverty. You know, what are they doing? What are we doing? Is there some sort of job training? Is there some sort of assistance? Because, I mean, people get off of programs, but that doesn't mean they still don't need help. You know, what are we doing?
There's that one program, is it called FSET, where if they're on food stamps, then they're able to be in this program called FSET. And FSET will actually pay for them to go to Gateway, and there's a whole list of certifications and licenses that they will pay for them to go through, and they pay for all their schooling during that time. I think they even pay for child care during that time. And I even like 3 months after they help them find a job, And then 3 months after, they even help them, like, get, like, if they need scrubs for their job. So say, for instance, I think the CNA licensure is on there. They pay for them to do that, and they help them get a job, and they also help them 3 months afterwards. So those are, like, some of the programs that we try to get them set up with, because they might not possibly have ever heard of those programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We do collect more than just, you know, are you on food stamps or not. We are looking at income levels, which we didn't report on.
Okay.
And things like that. So it isn't just, hey, we pushed you off the food stamps,
right.
But you don't have enough money to eat, so too bad.
Yeah.
There are strategic questions during their visits that they record, that they're working,
yes.
They graduated from high school, they're in college, so all of that, we're monitoring if, in fact, they are not making those self-sufficiency kind of moves, we're still encouraging them to do it. And supporting whatever they decide to do, but many of them, they get their income out because they get jobs that are really good jobs, and, they get training. So we don't leave
good.
Them out there by themselves.
Okay, yeah. And part of what we're doing is we're cheerleaders for some.
Yes.
Some of these families don't have a cheerleader.
Mm-hmm.
And,
or an advocate.
And we're that person
advocate.
That says yes, you can do it, and we help them to do that.
And sometimes that's all they need.
Yep.
Really.
Learning that a little bit in that you're talking CNA or some of those jobs.
Yes. What's next?
Yeah. Well, yeah, they need to keep moving up because those jobs really don't get you out of poverty.
Right.
Right. I mean, I don't know how many of our MAs or medical records people or whatever are still on Medicaid and everything else.
Yeah, doesn't pay a living wage.
It just hits you at that cusp.
I think some interesting research they've reflected is through this relationship with a nurse and the client,
mm-hmm.
how often they go into the healthcare field and how often they become nurses themselves. I think there's studies that are going on.
Well, then as far as workforce development, most of your skill and entry-level jobs are barely self-sufficient wages, and there has to be some kind of trajectory but when you're skilled and unskilled and starting with, you know, certificate programs and entry-level jobs, they can easily be built upon. But
yeah.
That is a...
They need to be able to be encouraged to keep going.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
And in the interest of time, and I think this is great, all this stuff people to do. I am gonna go ahead and have to do this.
So the next step, once they're at 3 years old, eventually they get into the school age, so that's where we take over. So school nurses are contracted with Kenosha Unified School District. We are made up of 4.8 FTE school nurses. A lot of them do other grants, so we're able to have more than that because they do other things, but they're available more often than. We have about 37 sites, KUSD schools that we serve. So our ratio is about one school nurse to 3,470 students. And that's if we're full time. We only have two of the nurses who actually work 40 hours that have that caseload. So the range is anybody can have two schools up to seven schools. We try not to go past seven because it's real difficult to manage that. So the student population, we have just over 16,000 students this school year. This is all from 16-17 school year. Of those, we have 2,572 students that have five of the most prevalent health conditions, asthma, allergies, cardiac conditions, diabetes, and seizures. And then we have, and that's about 15%, then we have another 7% that have additional conditions that aren't of the five main ones. So for those students who have accommodations necessary at school, we write emergency health plans. That was about 879 health plans. And last year, too, somebody had asked about the mental health diagnosis. We don't focus on that because those kids are followed by the counselors and the staff at school. The teachers have to write an IEP educational plan for them. But I was able to get a number. So of the students that we serve, we don't serve the three main high schools. And it's probably low because it's parent-reported, and a lot of parents don't want to know that their kid is handling ADHD, taking a med in the morning, getting through their day. But that's the number of self-reported
913, which is only about 5.4% of our population. I see you're...
Sorry to bother
that's,
you.
Yeah, I want
but,
to
but an IEP is not necessarily required if you have a mental health diagnosis.
Correct.
An IEP, I mean, so you, so is the 5.4% saying that we have...
That is the number of... We're in a report for conditions, and we went through if they had ADHD, schizophrenia, anxiety disorder, panic disorders. That includes all of those. So not necessarily ADHD with an IEP. That number is probably much smaller.
Okay, I was going to say, okay, so the IEP, okay, got it. I just want to make sure we were...
Yeah.
Because you can have the diagnosis numbers up here, but not have the IEP.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, so it's kind of a, it's a very general number, because I mean, okay, we're not going to get every parent to tell us what's going on with their child. So we've collected data for several years, so this is kind of a graph that shows where the health concerns are and where they've gone. So that dip you see in 2014-15 is when Infinite Campus came through. I don't know if you remember the same, but it's an electronic database, and we were learning how to read it, the parents were learning how to put their information in it, and not all those kids were healthy that year. We just didn't know about them. So I think we've recovered nicely, actually, with that. So parents are learning how to use it, we're understanding how to tell them what we need, so we're kind of at a same curve again. Asthma is something that we focused on. So we had the red line is kids with asthma, reported asthma, and the yellow line is the kids with their inhalers ready to go at school in case they have an asthma attack. We want to bring the gap closer. The only reason there's a closeness in 14-15 is because we didn't know about all those kids with asthma. We knew about them previously, but the kindergarten and pre-K or any new students weren't in the system yet. So that's why we saw the dip there. So our efforts were, we changed our letter that went out, we were calling parents, we were communicating with teachers, and we didn't really see an increase based on our efforts. So we're just continuing every year to review, what are we doing, how can we communicate better. The phone calls work best because explaining to the parent that, well, your child only needs the inhaler for Saturday soccer, well, they also play football at recess and they have to run the mile in gym, and music class is active, they dance during music. So yeah, your child actually did come down today and they asked for it, and I know they only need it during soccer, but they're just as active at school. And you can't explain that in a letter when they don't read past two lines. So the phone calls seem to be the most successful. Students with diabetes, this is type 1 diabetes only. And that one kind of peaked a little bit and then is kind of leveled out. We range about 50. So the numbers on the side are a little bit, they range about 50. It's not a very big gap there. Emergency health plans is a big part of what we do during the year. It goes all the way through the year because kids are diagnosed not always just before school starts. So throughout the years, they're diagnosed with conditions, they might need a health plan. We start in August updating the emergency health plans. The focus is seizures, diabetes, kids that can't start that first day without having a plan, some anaphylactic kiddos that really need people to know what the deal is before the day gets started. We're coordinating meetings with staff from the school, parents, sometimes the student is involved in plan, depending on their age level and ability. And we did 85 different types of health plans. And we have formats for them. They're all templated to try to keep them so that if somebody has to read the care plan, they know what they're looking for. They're looking the same. They don't have to read the entire thing to understand what to do. So I had talked about the five main health conditions. So there's about 80 other ones that we have to write up a specific health plan. So the number of health plans that we've done throughout the year, starting in 2005, where we started about 600, has kind of gone up. And then it peaks a little while, and then when Infinite Campus came in, those really healthy kindergartners, we've learned about who they are now, so we're recovering a little bit. So that's, we did about just under 900 care plans this year. Medications, that's the rest of our year, is figuring out what medications are coming in, if they're safe to give, safe doses, educating the staff on giving them. Anybody who comes across a student that might have to give a medication is trained, so that could be their teacher or counselor that goes with them on a field trip. So we just train all staff in the beginning of the year. We review medication orders, make sure that they're signed, that the parent and the physician have signed both of them if needed. Over-the-counter medication, making sure they're not bringing us adult doses of Tylenol to give to their kindergartner, things like that. Overnight field trips take on a different level because you're going to have to give that nighttime med or the meds that aren't given during school and understanding what they are. And these are parents who don't have medications at school, so they're not understanding always the policy, that they have to bring it in, not in a baggie, but it actually, the container that it was prescribed in, and the forms that need to take place. And then we do Medicaid billing for KUSD, so kiddos who have who are Medicaid eligible. It's an additional activity that we do to help KUSD recoup some of the cost. Numbers of students that receive daily medications, kind of, I have no rhyme or reason, it's up and down. And kids that are on daily medication, the majority are for behavioral medication, but we also do like lunchtime enzymes for cystic fibrosis. There's seizure medications that are three times a day sometimes. So, and I think it changed because sometimes you have a student on a behavioral med that no longer works, or they need to try something different because of side effects. So I think that explains why it's the up and down, different, you know, and it ranged between about 300 to 475. Medication disposal is the big issue at the end of the school year, which it ended on Friday. So of the 2,000 plus medications that were successfully finally brought in and we had all the forms, now we need to get rid of them. And we try to explain to parents how important it is to come pick up that medication, but it does not always happen. Last year, our medication disposal weighed, I think, 31 pounds. That was the first time we weighed it and kind of got an idea of what it was. So we'll see where we go from there. It takes about 1 to 2 hours per school to dispense the medications. There's a process that's involved in it, documenting, counting it. The campus has to be zeroed out. Medicaid billing has to be completed, and then the medications, we combine them, so we don't have all individual vials, but we can combine them, and the police department works well with us on disposing them with the police department. Staff trainings, since we are consultants, we are not always at our 37 schools, so a large part of it is training staff that does handle the student care during the day, focusing on diabetes care, treatment of anaphylaxis, EpiPen, epinephrine injection, seizure safety, how to give Diastat, asthma management, just how to walk them through using their inhaler, Heimlich maneuver, and then it's state mandated that anybody giving a medication to a student has to complete a training requirement, and we helped KUSD develop their training for that.
Good, thank you. Any questions?
Good question. Yes. What do they do with the kids on medication now that school's out until it starts again?
So we have summer school that starts next week, Monday. The policy for KUSD is medications that are in the morning should be given at home, so the student comes ready to go for their day, and they give doses when the student is in school, so usually at lunchtime. They're done at noon. So there are some high-risk families that principals work with that if student is obviously not getting the medication, they could be a danger to themselves or society without that medication, they take it upon themselves to alter that. You know, the policy states no, they take the responsibility and give the child the medication in the morning. Very few of them show up at summer school, so that usually does not continue through the summer because they're very inconsistent attendees.
So the FTEs that are there during the school year, what do they do now?
It's reduced greatly, so they don't work in the summer. Summer school is covered by 20 hours a week for the summer school. That's me.
Okay.
Yeah, and they have about 17 sites that are open for the summer school curriculum.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Cindy?
Just a couple of items to brief you on. We're venturing into telepsychiatry through the Department of Human Services. Health Department will be the fiscal agent for telepsychiatry. We'll be contracting this out through our Kenosha Human Development Services partners. And we've received $250,000 of funding from the Greater Milwaukee Foundation and through Aurora as an affiliate. So we're very pleased to be able to initiate this program into our community. At the State Public Health Conference, I was part of a presentation panel, and we presented on using an HIA to address health inequities caused by mass incarceration. Through an assessment at our health department, our Division of Health Reception
intake area on the second floor, which is kind of an FYI, we average about 144 phone calls per week. So the person that, the majority of the person that takes those calls is Aaron. So, quite a bit. Our restaurant license have been mailed out. We have initiated beach sampling out in the county area. Our laboratory had their ASCLAD or forensic accreditation site visit last week, and
Wednesday,
and didn't get a report from them or not yet.
Getting a report from them.
Okay.
So two things we're going to just paperwork wise straighten up.
Okay.
Otherwise, it was the sampling procedures, and that we're all in good shape.
Awesome.
So, but yeah, just so.
Minor
things, keeping track of some people use barcodes, keeping track of medications and that, drugs. So we have to look into that.
Okay, good. Thank you. Our medication assisted treatment program, an update on that. We have 104 clients that have received services, with 46 that are active currently in different phases of the program. Our district attorney first offenders program in the medication assisted treatment program, we have 12 active clients. And our new program for Narcan, the medication to reverse someone that is is under the influence of an opiate, we've distributed kits and trained our medical examiner staff, so that was our first group. And Amanda and Gianna, who are running this program, they presented at our healthcare executive roundtable, and the media, Kenosha News, had attended and did a very nice article. That's it.
The telepsychologist is going to be done where?
At KIDS. Kenosha Human Development Services will contract with them, and that'll be the location. We're offering children and adult psychiatry.
Starting immediately?
It takes 120 days to get a license to offer telepsychiatry at their behavioral health clinic. So we're going to initiate that immediately, and funding should have started like a while ago, but they're realigning, and it's been awesome that the money will start when we can get started. So any funding, which is awesome.
Needs a program.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah.
Other questions?
I'd just like to make a comment. As you know, I'm on the National Association of Local Boards of Health, and we have a conference coming up in first week of August. I'd like to encourage people to go. It's out in Cleveland. Yeah, I know, Cleveland. But it's a good way to meet other people on boards of health and to learn what other places are doing to solve the same problems we're running into. So just go to the NELBOA website and check it out.
Corporate counsel.
Really nothing to report.
Any other business?
I'll give a brief update on Shalom Center. We should be moving into the new building at 44th and 39th on August 15th. Everything's moving along really well. So we'll be vacating the current site and moving in there. I believe August 15th is a good date, so I think we're going to make it. And with the advent of the closing of First Step, we've actually do have three of their clients that came to us that agreed to follow the rules and enter the program. Two were alcoholics, one was mental health. One of them has obtained a job already, and the one with mental health unfortunately didn't make it. She acted up last week and assaulted another client, and so she didn't make it. So we're attempting to take care of some of the First Step clients that want help. If they want help, we'll give it to them. You know, there certainly are people that are functioning alcoholics and drug addicts. As long as they're not acting up and can play by our rules, follow our rules, you know, we're not intolerant. They can stay there. They can get help. We're pointing in the right directions. We have AA classes there twice a week. So, and at the new building, it's going to be a lot more program available. A lot more space. Health department will be open when they want. I mean, that's pretty, a lot of opportunities in a new site that we don't have now. So, yeah, there are three groups that are out there looking at replacing what First Step was doing. Cush has got a group together that is looking. County Board Supervisor Andy Burke is trying to get some type of plan together, and Journey Church. It'd be very difficult for them to locate another one in the city somewhere because of the track record of what had happened with the previous group. So, we'll see.
Okay, motion to adjourn.
So moved.